Hey everyone, welcome to Neighbor Science. I am Ryan Salisbury.
Hey everyone, welcome to Neighbor Science, and I'm Peter DeBeer.
Today we're talking about Buttcoin, the nerd money that everyone loves a lot. Do you have any of these Buttcoins, Peter?
I was going to invest in Buttcoins when they first came out. But then I realized that it took a lot of computing power, and I was at the time running off a really tiny, small, stupid little computer, and so I decided not to. And now I'm really happy that I didn't, because I already have anxiety issues and I don't want any more.
I think I'm actually one of those people that like had a Bitcoin or two in 2010 or 2009 that I like mined with my gaming computer and just lost the wallet. So I could have like an extra, what, $13,000 or whatever right now. But I don't. So that's
no,
cool.
You don't.
Yeah, no. I guess I also could have invented online Walmart and, you know, had $100 billion, but I didn't do that either.
I had that idea back in 1983 when...
Online Walmart?
Yeah. I had...
How old were you then?
I was one.
Okay. And, well, we are both genius experts at business, so...
Yeah, we're tier one genius experts at everything. but at the time, you know, it was a toss-up. Do I create online Walmart, or do I play with my stuffed toys? And in all honesty, it's a no-brainer. My stuffed toys were awesome.
Yeah, no regrets, man.
Nothing. Nada. Zip, zilch, zero. Okay, so we're going to talk about Buttcoin and more generally about blockchain and blockchain
like
technology.
Cock-chain.
And I hadn't even thought of that one, to be honest.
Just came up with it with my genius business brain.
There we go. Nice. yeah, that's a TM, everyone.
Yeah.
Okay, so being that we're both geniuses, I am smart enough to know what I don't know, and what I don't know is the technical aspects of how Bitcoin and blockchain works.
That makes you smarter than someone who does know things, because you know that you don't know, and that's what's truly important. That's what makes someone really smart, is knowing that they don't know, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Actually.
It's the reverse Dunning-Kruger effect.
Exactly. I was almost wrong, but now I'm not. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to very quickly very quickly is not going to happen because of the subject matter. But briefly, Ryan is going to explain to me specifically and all our listeners incidentally what blockchain and Bitcoin are.
Okay. So you did, just before I start, you did block off about 3 hours for this, right?
Seven.
Okay, good,
seven.
Good.
I mean, so that's what I figured.
I can take it leisurely. I don't have to speak as fast as I can. That's good.
You don't need to do the horse race announcer speech.
Okay, good. So before I really get into Buttcoin and cockchain, I'm going to explain some basic concepts for people who don't know anything about computer science so that you can understand the rest. So to start with, the most important thing to know is what a hash is. And a hash is basically just a function takes...
Stop. Huh? Stop right there. Huh? I know what hash is. I know what it is. It's the oil that comes out of cannabis that you then compress and you smoke it, right?
Actually, it's a different one, different kind.
This one's made of
potatoes, and you eat it for breakfast.
Awesome.
Yeah, so that's what the basis of blockchain is breakfast potato meals. a hash is a function that takes a piece of data and produces a number or a string of hexadecimal numbers. So it's used commonly to like verify data. So you can take an entire file, run a hash function over it, and it'll produce this, you know, string of numbers. And then you can take another file that is supposed to be the same and run the hash function over it, and it'll produce hopefully the same series of numbers. And the whole point is that any small change in the input produces a very large change in the output. So if there's like a couple of bits that are different about the second file, then it'll produce a totally different hash, and you'll know immediately that the data is corrupted or it's not the same file or whatever. It's used in cryptography a lot, and yeah, it's used in a ton of stuff.
Security
is the basis of Bitcoin. Huh? Yeah, security.
Yeah, that's basically what it boils down to.
Yeah. I mean, it's also used in some data structures to put things into buckets, but that's not really, you know, we don't need to get into that. It's a fascinating subject, hashing, but we're going to go to blockchain instead. So what does blockchain try to solve? Most generally, it tries to solve the problem of keeping a set of records common to a group of strangers, which involves both establishing which records describing facts about reality are true, and what is the true order of those records. So not only do you have to know what happened, but if the facts are related to one another in any way, such as, you know, a ledger of spending and receiving, you have to know what is the correct order. So if we have the facts, Ryan has one coin, Ryan gives one coin to Peter, and Ryan gives one coin to Maiko, the order of these matters, because I only have one coin to give, and so if I try to give one to both Peter and Mike, then one of those latter two facts has to be false. So we have to figure out what the order is. And so this is called the double spending problem. It's making sure that someone who has a butt coin can't spend that butt coin on more than one butt. So the blockchain attempts to solve this problem by having miners compete for a solution to a problem called partial hash inversion. And I should have explained this before, but one of the things about hashing is that it's very easy to run a hash function, but it's very, very difficult to do like an inverse of a hash function. So to like find the pieces of data that would go into a hash function to produce like a given output. So unlike addition, where, you know, you can figure out easily the reverse operation of it, figuring out the reverse operation of a hash is extremely difficult. And it's actually the basis for most cryptography used like on the web, which is called public key cryptography. The same kind of thing is the basis for that. And that's actually one of the things that quantum computers are supposed to be good at, is solving these difficult to reverse mathematical operations. So partial hash inversion means finding a value called a nonce, and that is not the witty British insult. It's a cryptographic value used to add randomness to a hash function or a cryptographic function. So it means finding a value called a nonce that can be included in a new block of records along with the hash of the previous block of records, hence the chain part of blockchain. And that whole thing is hashed to produce a number that starts with a certain amount of zeros. So partial hash inversion is very difficult to solve, and that's supposed to provide the security of the blockchain. But as I said before, verifying the solution is trivial. So so that's the basic explanation of blockchain.
Okay, so now we know what a block is, what a blockchain is, and we know now essentially how it functions.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so when you when someone finds the solution to that partial hash inversion, they are given Bitcoin for that. So
okay. So yeah. I mean, that's essentially what Bitcoin mining is then.
Yes, and the network is designed so that if mining power increases on the network, so if people are able to solve those partial hash inversions faster, which is basically the only way to do it is to brute force it. So it's like if the number of hashes per second increase, it will vary the amount of zeros before the hash value that you have to find, which is called like the difficulty. And it varies it to ensure that a Bitcoin is created about every 10 minutes.
So one new Bitcoin every 10 minutes.
I think the number of coins varies. It's one block every, like one verified block every 10 minutes.
Okay. Okay, because I read somewhere that on average, when a block is created, the reward for the miner is around 15 Bitcoin.
Okay, yeah. That part I didn't get to, so that's good to know. Yeah, so this is all, it's very spectacular technology, but we should refer back to the beginning of the partial hash inversion part. Blockchain solves the double spending problem by competing to be the first to verify a fact. So what this means is there are, you know, a bunch of people competing to create a verified block, but there's nothing that says like which set of records and which order of those records the person has to compete to verify. So basically, whoever verifies the block first gets to determine the truth. So there's actually a type of attack on this network called the 51% attack, which is basically if someone gains over half of all mining power in the network, they can essentially just solve blocks faster than everyone else and determine exactly what sets of transactions they want to be in the blockchain. So that means that contrary to Bitcoin being called censorship proof or whatever, it's actually possible to censor it perfectly well as long as you have over half of all the mining power.
Okay, so I mean that would be quite a big problem then, wouldn't it? I mean, half the setting point of Bitcoin is that it's decentralized and therefore it can't really be messed with.
Yeah, free from government interference and everything. Yeah, well, I have an excerpt from an article. I'm a little disorganized right now. This is about the article is called Blockchain's Immutability Myth or some shit like that. It's on some Nerd Money website. So it talks about the 51% attack. Part of the one thing that's important to understand about that is it is possible for two people to solve partial hash inversion at the same time. And what happens in the event of a tie is whoever solves the next block in one of those two blockchains, like in the forked blockchain, that is the blockchain that gets adopted by the rest of the network. And so it boils down to whoever has the longest blockchain is like the one that is the most true. This article makes the point that Bitcoin is being used by Chinese citizens to circumvent their country's capital controls. And the Chinese government's tax revenues are about $3 trillion per year. So it could actually do one of these 51% attacks with only 0.04% of its budget. And the idea that many Bitcoin dorks have, which is that the 51% attack is impossible, obviously spending 0.04% of your budget to perform a 51% attack is extremely possible and kind of desirable if China wants to crack down on this this illegal spending in its country.
Yeah, I was having a discussion with someone, and they were saying to me that the 51% attack, which at the time I didn't fully understand, but I do now, they were saying that it's impossible because Bitcoin is already so huge that the computing power for it takes up more electricity than is used by 159 countries around the world. Now, these are obviously individual countries. Like, it uses more electricity than the country of Bahrain. It uses more electricity than the various small countries. But the moment you start looking at the the other 30-odd countries that don't have a tiny energy budget, it starts becoming pretty easy. I mean, as far as I know, Bitcoin uses the equivalent energy of about 2% of, or even less, of the U.S. energy budget.
Yeah, it probably only uses about as much electricity as my neighborhood.
Well, the estimate that I saw said something along the lines of like
10 American households.
No, it was it was close to like 20 million or something like that.
Oh, that's not bad.
Which is still tiny if you compare it to the rest of the U.S. population. Oh, yeah. And industry and I mean, it's tiny. People, yeah. People are looking at Bitcoin as if it's this monolith, but it's not. And so,
yeah, that's like what, yeah. 1/15 of the population or something like that.
Yeah, tiny man.
Something like that. Another point that the author makes is the majority of Bitcoin mining already takes place in China. I think it's like 2/3 of mining capacity. Wow. Is in China, due to low cost hydroelectric power and climate and other factors. So the Chinese army could easily just seize the Bitcoin mining operations and use them to do a 51% attack. So they don't even have to develop new mining capacity. They can just take what is already there, and they could do it easily because China, yeah, has a very big army. And yeah, what are those Bitcoin dorks going to do? Probably not a lot.
And it's, and I mean,
some assault rifles. Nope.
Yeah, the main reason why they won't do that is because they'd have to spend some of their Bitcoin to do that.
Yeah.
Okay, but now we're also looking at a China where Xi Jinping is he's basically just signed on another term. He's well on his way to becoming the next emperor of China at this stage. And it, I mean, he's been consolidating power in the country for a while now, and yeah, if he starts feeling like the Chinese people are trying to evade taxes by going the cryptocurrency route, I see no reason why he won't follow South Korea and Japan and England and everything and start really cracking down. And if it comes down to it, a 51% attack, like you've said, it's not beyond belief.
Yeah. The only thing, though, for me is China is a very very dirigist country, which means that the government takes a direct role in controlling the economy. And they're currently growing extremely fast still. So I don't think they really, I don't know if they buy into the myth that, you know, most Western countries, well, most capitalist countries buy into, which is that you need to collect tax revenue in order to spend from the government. I don't know that they buy into that, so I don't know if they would really care about people evading taxes as long as they have a functioning market economy, you know, because that's the primary motivation to tax the populace is to force them to use your currency. So people are already using the currency. So I guess unless people really start using Bitcoin to conduct business within China and make their daily purchases, I don't really think that they're going to do anything that crazy. Especially if the Bitcoin miners are converting their Bitcoin to Chinese currency to spend it. So,
yeah, and I think that sort of hits on your next point, where, I mean, Bitcoin isn't really being used as currency.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's traded as a currency, but it doesn't function in the same way as a currency does.
Right.
Here in Bahrain, we've got the Bahraini dinar, and it's a very strong currency. I think it trades at three times. I think you get $3 to a dinar. You get like 35 rand to a dinar. So, I mean, it's a very strong currency in the global perspective. And like, I've heard of people here hoarding some Bitcoin, but no one uses it at all.
Yeah.
At all. In South Africa, before I left, there was a Bitcoin ATM that had opened up in Johannesburg.
Oh, yeah. I remember and, you telling me about that.
Yeah. And it was actually quite hilarious because 6 months down the line, it had two people use it.
Nice.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, so you've got this currency that is going up in value. Why would you sell it?
Yeah. So I guess I'll just get into this whole thing if you want.
Yeah, I do want you to.
Okay.
I was sort of hinting, but you seem to be reticent.
Again, I was trying to let you finish. I don't want to talk over you the whole time, you know?
Oh, you're so sweet, Ryan.
I know. So before I start on this section, just a little bit of differentiation. I use the terms money and currency to refer to distinct things. So in most countries, money and a currency are basically the same. What a money is a unit. So it's a unit of measurement. So the U.S. dollar is a money, and we know it's a money because we can go to the store and see things that are measured in U.S. dollars. And what I'm referring to is the price of the thing. A currency is denoted in some sort of money, but it's the actual thing that you hand over when you go to buy the thing. So the number of units of currency that you hand over are measured by the price, which is measured in a money. So I'm going to talk about why Bitcoin is not functioning as money and why it's seldom functioning as currency.
Cool.
So Bitcoin fundamentally rests on neoclassical and right libertarian foundations. So it assumes that the state and the market are completely distinct spheres of society. It assumes that monies of exchange, like monies that are used to denote prices for traded goods, can come through spontaneous or decentralized social organization rather than from a centralized state. And in fact, it assumes that that's where they all came from. I'm in this like anarcho-capitalist Facebook group. One of the good ones that like kicks out fasci ANCAPs and stuff, but they're still ANCAPs. So I went and asked, like, where do ANCAPs and libertarians believe money came from? And pretty much the universal answer was, well, traders invented money, and then the state co-opted it.
I'll be honest, I saw you post that, and I've been following it, and I've been giggling silently on the side.
I think their history of money comes from like Murray Rothbard. One of them linked me or referred me to a book by Rothbard that we may do a future episode on because it's pretty ridiculous.
Oh my God.
And Rothbard is always good for a laugh.
Yes. Yes. Rothbard, man, he is the king of economic comedy.
Yeah. Yeah. The king dork of anarcho-capitalism.
I mean, I think the only person that might beat him out is von Mises.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, where was I in here? libertarians and ANCAPs also assume that markets are supposed to be politically neutral. And so, they have no real theory of where money actually comes from. They believe that it came from merchants that were just like really smart guys who were bartering, and then they decided that was just too inconvenient, and they formulated the problem of the double coincidence of wants that you learn in Econ 101, which just so happens to be historical reality. Bitcoin likewise has no real theory of where money actually comes from or where it's supposed to come from, and due to the apolitical supposed nature, it's only spending any currency on maintaining the ledger, the blockchain. So the only thing that gets you a Bitcoin is verifying Bitcoin spending. There's no body that says, we need people that are doing this. So if you do this, we'll give you Bitcoin. Kind of like the primary contractor for a government.
Yeah, but at no point, I read through the thread, and at no point does anyone actually come out and talk about the fact that they're essentially relying on the infinite regression problem. If the only way that you can get a Bitcoin is by verifying Bitcoin transactions, where did the first Bitcoin come from?
Yeah, the first Bitcoin came from, it's called the Genesis block, and it basically just came from Satoshi starting up Bitcoin. So he got the first 15 or whatever Bitcoin, and then I think blocks don't actually have to have any records in them, so a lot of the early ones are probably empty. So they were maintaining an empty ledger, and so for verifying that empty ledger, they got some Bitcoin, which makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, and at that point, it snowballed. But what's interesting for me is the very, very apt analogy, and it's like beautifully poetic metaphor of the origin of Bitcoin being essentially empty.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, it doesn't even really match with their like kind of empty theory of where money comes from, because those merchants were trading something, so they
were bartering.
Supposedly created money to facilitate trade that was actually happening. Whereas here, they're creating money to facilitate having money, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, I don't really blame people for misunderstanding the origin of money. I remember in primary school, I was taught.
Oh, yeah, we're taught terribly wrong things about where money comes from. I think everyone is taught the barter myth, pretty much.
Everybody is taught the barter myth, and it's the self-reinforcing concept, because it seems to make sense if you don't understand history at all and you've never looked at it.
Or you've never thought about the social interaction that would take place in a barter economy. Like,
and
you have three neighbors, and you have apples and want oranges, and your neighbor has bananas and wants chickens. Oh no, barter doesn't work. Like that's even what they say, like when they're talking about how money replaced barter. They're like, oh yeah, there's this problem where like you could want something and then the thing that you have, like, no one else wants. It's like, so we survived like that for thousands of years or whatever before anyone came up with trading something other than physical goods. That seems unlikely to me.
Yeah, and I mean, if you think about it, it really does make sense that the people who invented money, and no, I'm not talking about an evil Jewspiracy. the people who invented money were essentially the state.
Yeah,
and
I mean, there was money used before states were outside of states, but it was used for things other than trade, which is why I specifically said money of something. I don't remember what word it was specifically,
yeah,
but
yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, it makes sense that they would create this myth sort of to let people go on using what they think is something that they are a part of creating, that it is created by their wants and needs and their supply and demand and their interaction with the economy. When, I mean, the harsh truth is that governments basically just make the shit up.
Yeah.
And the if you then go look at the first education systems where these myths became official, it makes a sick sort of sense that they did this.
Yeah. And so if you want to learn more about the history of money, highly recommend Debt, the First 5,000 Years by David Graeber. If you've never read it, one of the things that he points out kind of repeatedly in the book is there's never actually been any evidence of a society based on barter. So, never.
Yeah. So, I mean, the only recorded cases of barter, according to Graeber and several other...
Yeah, he's going based off anthropological evidence,
evidence.
Just himself. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not just like, oh, let me suck this out of my thumb.
Yeah.
He is an anthropologist. He studies the history of human societies. And the only evidence for barter that existed was on the outskirts of massive empires, such as the Incan Empire, where they were dealing with essentially outgroups.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was for singular kind of items, like they need salt or whatever. And internally, that entire empire was run on a gift economy. So
yeah, barter is much easier if you're a large organization with a lot of resources, like a diverse pool of resources, so that if you're trying to trade with another large organization, you can say, like, oh, I want this from you. We have this. What do you want? If you're just like a single person and you only produce a single thing, which is what people who think the barter economy existed think reality was like, then, yeah, you're going to have that double coincidence of wants shit, and you're going to have something that the person that has what you want doesn't want. So...
Yeah, and I also think that the reason that these ANCAPs and libertarians and all of that, the reason why their example is so simplistic is because they learned about this when they were kids, and they've never really updated their knowledge. They've never really looked at the history of money. They've never gone past that initial fundamentally flawed understanding of how money was created.
Yeah. Yeah, I think another part of it is, you know, neoclassical economics is very overly simplified. Like the theories that go into justifying the you know, the laissez-faire structure of the economy is there are infinitely many individual producers and individual consumers, and there's only one commodity in the economy, and all of those consumers have exactly the same preferences, so there's really only one. They basically assume away, like, everything about reality that makes it complex and not follow this model in any way, shape, or form. And so, you know, the logic that you can base off of that is obviously going to be very simplistic as well. So, yeah. Another thing that goes into this barter myth, I think, is if you look at, like, very early states like Mesopotamia, they charged taxes in terms of grain. And I think they also priced things in terms of grain. So for the casual observer, this would appear to be barter, because you're trading grain, which is a good, for a different good. But in that case, grain would actually be a money, because it's used to price things. It's a unit of measurement. And I mean, the reason that they used grains, because early states ran completely on grain. It was the most important crop by far. It was very conducive to bureaucracy, as I think I mentioned in our interview with Blair. And yeah, so again, to the casual onlooker, this can appear to be barter, but it's actually money and, you know, money spending. So, so why is Bitcoin not functioning as money and seldom as currency? Now that we've gone pretty far off track.
I think we're still on track. It just required a bit of explanation.
We had to go back to the
people...
station a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not our fault that it's a roundabout route.
Yeah.
You know,
it's not our fault that everyone else is stupid and doesn't understand economics and needs to take economics 101.
Yeah.
So, I'm trying to find my place again. Sorry. Okay. So libertarians tend to think that money and currency are invented by individuals to replace barter, and then are later co-opted by the state. And while the state can distort the market of currency, prior to that, currency was adopted thanks to supply and demand. So put another way, currency only has value because people believe it has value. So this fundamentally means that the plan for cryptocurrency adoption is nothing more than making it popular, which happens through undetermined means. So in practice, the means of making it popular is by treating it like a medium or long-term security. So I have a poll from this investment website called LendEDU. And so they did a poll about a couple polls about Bitcoin. And so I've picked out a couple of the questions here. The first one is, which of the following best describes the reason you invested in Bitcoin? Which describes the reason you invented Bitcoin? So 21 point, I'm not going to do the point shit. That doesn't matter. 22% of respondents answered Bitcoin is a long-term store of value like gold or silver. So that's kind of unclear whether they consider it money, because a lot of libertarians think that fiat currency is not real currency, and that only currency backed by the gold standard or the silver standard are like real.
It's gonna be pegged to something real, man.
Yeah.
Something real and something that we know is really valuable, like jewelry.
Like gold, whose value never fluctuates at all.
Ever.
Remarkably stable price there. So that's 22% of respondents. So 41% of respondents answered, I believe Bitcoin is a world changing technology. Okay. Sure. 14% answered, I believe the price of Bitcoin is too low and will only go higher. So that's very clearly they're going to invest in it as a security. or at least 4x. If you want to make the case that it's currency, then we can call it 4x. 15% answered family, friend or family member convinced me to invest. 8% answered I plan on using Bitcoin for transactions or purchases and less of an investment. So only 8% definitively are planning to use it as currency.
92% basically said it's a security.
Yes. You know, 22% of those, it's kind of up in the air whether they think of it as an investment like investing in gold or think of it as a money to be used after the apocalypse when we have abundant electricity and internet available. Just like, you know, if we had the apocalypse and you had a bunch of gold and we have readily available scales and can measure out
It was always my favorite scene in Mad Max when they was having those email chats.
Oh yeah, yeah. Especially when you know, Max, that's the main guy, Max.
Yeah,
when he got fished and you know, someone hacked his computer and downloaded all his porn.
It was hilarious. Yeah, it was hilarious.
That was one of the deleted ones.
You guys need to go and watch Mad Max again, but get the Blu-ray box set triple director's cut edition. It has the deleted fishing scene.
Yeah, in between the first car chase and when they are browsing 4chan for memes, that's where it's going to be. Okay, so some more questions from this poll reveal that most people think it should be treated like a capital asset. So one question is, if possible, would you rather own Bitcoin through an exchange-traded fund, also known as an ETF, that accurately tracked the actual price of Bitcoin? 50% of respondents answered yes. 16% answered no, and 34% answered unsure. So
literally a third of people are like, huh?
Yeah. I don't know what that means. But half of people think, yes, it's a security and I want to trade it through an exchange traded fund. So the next one, if possible, would you rather own Bitcoin through futures contracts? And what that means, if I understand correctly, I'm not great at financial instruments, but I believe that means you bet on what the future price of an asset is going to be, something like that. So for that one, 43% answered yes, 23% answered no, and 34% answered unsure.
That to me is just the strangest thing. So literally 42% of people would rather own their Bitcoins based on bets on the future price of Bitcoin. It's more volatile than fucking helium.
I don't know if futures contracts require you to like specify an exact price. I think the idea is
it going to go above or below its current price?
Yeah, I think it's something like that. In fact, I should probably just look this up so I don't sound like a total dingus. So I'm going to go ahead and do that right now.
Okay, while you do that, I'm going to just quickly power through the next question where they ask, do you believe Bitcoin should be classified as a commodity or a security? And there, 31% of the respondents answered that it should be a commodity. 39% said it should be a security. And about 29% were like, huh? So again, we've got about a third of the population has no idea about the difference between commodities, securities, assets. They don't know. They're literally just dupes. It's that they go, I want me some Bitcoin. I don't know why whenever I do a stupid American, they're always from the South, because I know some really clever people.
Classism.
Yeah. I think that's it.
So according to Wikipedia, I was completely wrong. Future is actually a rapper named Navidius Damon Wilburn. So, apologies about that. So,
yeah.
Most people would rather own Bitcoin through a contract with the rapper Future. My bad. I was pretty much correct. So it's a legal agreement to buy or sell something at a predetermined price at a specified time in the future. So they're just betting that the price is going to go a certain way. I think short sales probably count as a future. But yeah, I think it's shorts and options or some shit like that. I don't know. Yeah. Finance is stupid. If you're in finance, you're stupid.
Even though the show Billions is brilliant.
I've never seen it.
Have you never seen it? I highly recommend it. I don't know if you remember a while back, I started a little conversation in one of the Facebook groups we were in about playing capitalists off against each other.
Uh-huh.
And it's all based on watching the series Billions and how it's this game of power that they play amongst themselves.
Uh-huh.
It's a good series. I highly recommend it.
Do they do any trading with the rapper Future?
I'm almost sure they do.
Okay. I'll check IMDb to see if he's in the show.
Yeah. Yeah, you do that.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So, you know, from those poll questions, I think it's pretty clear that most people consider Bitcoin more of an investment than anything else, especially a currency.
Yeah, it's not money to be used when going to the corner store to get yourself some milk.
Yeah, I mean, you can't do that at all. Probably anywhere.
There is a single little blip in that radar.
Okay.
That I'm just going to bring up now. And then
in the next. Is it on an offshore oil rig by any chance? Like an abandoned oil rig? Okay.
I just very quickly wanted to mention that the one time I've heard of someone putting something up for sale through Bitcoin was back in 2014. And I was very grateful at the time that I didn't have any Bitcoin, so that I wasn't even remotely tempted to waste my money on an album by 50 Cent.
Oh yeah. He's a more of a millionaire now because of
nerds
who bought his album with Bitcoin.
Yeah, so let me just quickly tell the story. Basically, what happened was that 50 Cent, who's now obviously going to be changing his name to 700 Bitcoin, he got a bunch of people to buy his album using Bitcoin. Now, this is back in 2014. And then he forgot about it, much like you forgot about your wallet and lost
it. Pretty much everyone forgets about their Bitcoin.
Exactly. Now that Bitcoin, obviously 700 Bitcoin with a conversion rate, is worth several million dollars. And he's no longer broke, as he declared in 2015 when he posted an image of himself on Instagram stating that he was broke by spelling it out with stacks of $100 bills.
Yeah, that's what I do when I'm broke. Get the $10,000 that I have in my bank account and turn it into cash and then post about it on Instagram.
My favorite when I'm broke is to print out to go and draw some of my change of the millions of dollars I have in the bank and just lay it out on my bed and then do money angels.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, because I love the feel of dirty money on my skin.
Well,
yeah, so
since
that's
this
pretty
whole thing's
much
played
only
out, maybe next time I'm broke, I will, get a bunch of $10,000 checks and use those to spell out, please send help, or something like that.
SOS, buddy. Which, by the way, does not mean save our souls.
It means stop our selves?
No, it's actually Latin. It's
subordinous, ostentatious, supercilious. Right?
I'm trying to remember exactly what it was.
I thought it was just supposed to be a recognizable pattern of Morse code. I don't think it's actually an acronym at all. There's a bunch of backronyms for it, but I don't think it was ever intended to be an acronym.
The original Latin, I promise you, right now. I need to look it up now. It's going to absolutely drive me insane.
I believe what it translates to is help, bitch. I think that's what it means.
Okay, yeah, I found it on a list of Latin abbreviations. Mm-hmm. Don't ask me why I was looking this up. I can't for the life of me remember. But it stands for C opus seat. Which translate to if there is need or if occasion requires or if necessary.
So kind of like Mullen
Please
Labe,
come
right?
and help me if at all it is necessary. Much like Hollywood, Latin is always British to me.
Since we're on the subject, the only two acceptable things to use in Latin when you're writing, e.g. and i.e. Anything else, don't fucking do it. Ceteris paribus, all those other things that fucking nerds say, don't do that.
Exempli gratia.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, what's the other one? It's like nullus dullus. I don't know.
Nota bene?
Isn't that what chefs say when they make something delicious?
No, no, it's what you write at the end of a letter when you've got more to add.
Oh, here it is. Mutatis mutandis. Yeah, if you use that, go fuck yourself. Don't do that. Do not.
Unless you're doing a reenactment of Harry Potter.
Mm-mm,
in which case, it is totally allowed if you're doing Harry Potter and you need to make up spells that you don't know.
No, translate it all into English.
Okay, the only other one that I think should still be allowed is et al. I love it.
Okay, yeah. Sure. Yeah, you can use that one.
Okay, great. Now, getting back on track.
Yeah. I think it was a worthwhile detour there.
Like, you've got to learn something new every day, and now I've just taught everyone what SOS stands for.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so now that we know that people consider Bitcoin to be more of a security or some kind of asset that they want to make money off of, that means that the hope for Bitcoin is that the price of a Bitcoin, as denoted in national currencies like the US dollar, will just increase continuously. So the people who hold Bitcoin want Bitcoin to be worth, you know, $1 billion so that they can all be billionaires. So what happens when that's the case for something that's being used for purchases? So first of all, let's look at how Bitcoin are actually used for purchases. So usually a merchant will just use a service like BitPay. So BitPay has an app that will calculate your Bitcoin exchange rate at the time of purchase. They give a window of 10 to 15 minutes so that the customer can pay before the invoice expires. And so that's used to deal with the volatility of the exchange rate between Bitcoin and whatever the local currency is that the merchant uses. So the merchant receives a cash settlement at the end of the day, or they have the Bitcoin transferred to a wallet that they control. So if a merchant isn't using BitPay, then they use something else like CoinKite or Coinbase. Same idea. They use software to convert the price into the local current, the local money. Sorry, I've been using that wrong. The local money. And if they don't use any of those and they just try to handle it themselves, they may choose to price everything in Bitcoin exclusively and make changes periodically, or just do the same kind of thing, translate it to their local money. So for the vast majority of the time, if you are buying an item with Bitcoin, it is not priced in Bitcoin. It's priced in whatever currency the merchant accepts. Or whatever money. Yeah, whatever currency the merchant accepts. Yes. So that means that if if Bitcoin is being used as a currency, as in a means of payment, it's not being used as a money, as in a unit of payment. So the money is whichever money of state is used in the business's home country. So the thing that you're buying is priced in dollars, not bitcoins. So because the prices of the products are in dollars, the continually increasing price of Bitcoin in terms of dollars means that the price of products in terms of Bitcoin is continually decreasing. In other words, Bitcoin is a extremely, extremely deflationary currency. And
I just want to take this one step further. Let's say that Bitcoin continues to grow at an exponential rate. And I mean, obviously, there's a cap set at the moment at 21 million Bitcoins. But let's say that the dollar value of Bitcoin continues to rise and it eventually reaches the 10 billion mark. By the same rationale, because it's kept inflating the way it has, and products and services have then continually deflated mm-hmm. in response, doesn't that then imply that the use of or the growth of Bitcoin leads to the point where Bitcoins are rendered absolutely meaningless because products and services no longer require anything? I mean, if it's reduced to, if everything across the board is reduced to 1 cent, then having $1 billion is fucking pointless.
I mean, I guess you can still buy a lot of stuff with $1 billion if everything costs a cent.
Yeah, but so can everyone else who don't have $1 billion, who only have $10. At the end of the day, if the Bitcoin keeps increasing and it keeps devaluing, or deflating the price of goods and services, then eventually, I mean, it's a finite economy. It has to reach zero.
Yeah. I mean, the Bitcoin can be divided into, like, I think 100,000 units.
Yeah.
Like one Bitcoin can be divided into like 1/100,000th of a Bitcoin and spent that way. And then there's something called like off-chain transactions that can be even smaller. So I don't know. It could be still useful. But I think the bigger problem is if the price of Bitcoin is increasing exponentially, why the fuck would you ever spend it on anything?
Yeah.
You know, if basically like if your coin is going to go up by $1,000 tomorrow, why the fuck would you ever spend it on anything? Just spend dollars because you already are paid in dollars. You buy all your goods with dollars. The thing is priced in dollars. So just use dollars, because otherwise you're stupid and you're like losing money, because you could just hold on to your Bitcoin and it could be worth more and then you can sell it for more dollars. So that's, I think, the core problem of Bitcoin is
there's no incentive to spend it.
Yeah. Yeah. And this comes again from this idea that, you know, currencies become, used because people want to use them because they like trading. That's it. That's the only thing that's required. You don't need a available employment that pays in that unit of money or currency. You don't need a diverse array of products, many of which are essential to your ability to survive. And you don't need taxes, because taxes are theft. They're evil. Only the state does taxes. There's no such thing as rent. Rent is voluntary. So all we need to do is make people like Bitcoin, and then Bitcoin will take over, and then the state will crumble. That's the whole idea, really.
Basically, yeah. Oh, just for information purposes, I've just double checked, and since we spoke 2 minutes ago, the price of Bitcoin has dropped down to $10,425.
Oh. Oh, so my calculations were inaccurate.
As they will be within any 2 minute period, really.
So what was the high? Was it like, it was something like 16,000 at one point, right?
It got to just below 20 at about the end of December, beginning of January, and it has devalued by approximately 30%. No more. It's basically halved its value in the last month.
Halved. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So people that bought Bitcoin 3 months ago, if they were to sell today, they'd be breaking even more or less.
So now if you bought your Bitcoin at $16,000, you'd probably be pretty smart to spend it now.
especially once we discuss what I'm going to discuss after you discuss what you're discussing.
Yeah, I'm pretty much done. So if you want to go ahead and start your section,
you're done?
That'd be great. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So most Bitcoin investors will tell you that the volatility of the blockchain currency is purely random, and it reflects the decentralized nature of the technology. Several of the people that I've spoken to insist that price jumps and pullbacks that are seen on such a regular basis are purely driven by market forces.
Which we know is not true, because there was a big scandal like 1 or 2 years ago about Mt. Gox manipulating the price of Bitcoin.
Indeed. So basically, what they think is that individuals that require Bitcoin for transactions are the reason for price jumps, and that pullbacks happen because of a need to convert to dollars for real world goods, and that these actions have some sort of strong effect on the overall performance of the digital currency.
Wait, you mean you can't use Bitcoin for real world goods? They have to convert it to dollars?
Figure that one.
Wow.
Of course, we know that nothing could be further from the truth. Bitcoin is essentially driven by fear. It is purchased because investors fear that they're missing out on potential profits.
FOMO.
And they're also afraid of investing in more mediocre stocks or currencies that may be more closely regulated by, you know, big bad government.
YOLO.
So the moment that the big bad government so much as sneezes something that seems regulatory, they sell. And this has actually been shown quite extensively, that Bitcoin, the price of Bitcoin, is most closely correlated to regulation. The moment anyone says regulation, people sell. The moment they talk about deregulation, people buy. And if you start thinking about your libertarian community and your ANCAP community and their fundamental misunderstanding of how money works, and not understanding that it is the state that creates that creates money, their view that the government is interfering in markets and so on, that it starts to make sense that the currency would fluctuate so heavily, especially if you then consider the fact that it's heavily your libertarian community that are so heavily invested in it. The most recent drop in Bitcoin price has very specifically been driven by regulation proposals in several countries, from India and China to Korea to Britain, Japan. And there's also been quite a heavy clampdown within the US by the SEC. And I mean, let's not kid ourselves. There definitely needs to be regulation of this entire technology, with hacks resulting in hundreds of millions of dollars in tokens being stolen and scams running rampant. The entire industry needs to be very closely supervised.
I'd say let it happen.
Well, to a certain extent, obviously I'm not a big fan of hierarchies like governments. But at the same time, I'm also from a country that has extremely high crime rates, and I'm not a big fan of the kind of crime that can happen here.
I think you're associating this crime with the type of people that you live with instead of the type of people that I live with, which are rich nerds who are assholes and who should have all their money taken from them and deserve whatever happens.
Okay. It's not just con artists and crypto hackers that are causing concerns. Wall Street, like we said just now, has gotten in on the scamming by pushing the classic pump and dump trading in order to artificially inflate prices. Okay? This is what I mean by the SEC stepping in. They have identified several pump and dump scams that have been going on, where a pump and dump scam is where traders will artificially inflate a price by buying it and buying it and buying it and buying it. And then at a pivotal moment, they'll sell once the price is at a massive high, which then completely devaluates everything, and the market bottom drops out, and it ends up being a lot less lucrative for those who are not in they're not privy to the coordination that happens within these hedge funds and this is the big thing. Is at the end of the day, it's not just the rich kids sitting in the neighborhood house wanting to buy Steam games. It's Wall Street that is running the major big ones. They're the ones that are screwing with people that have been convinced to invest in Bitcoin as a security, who have taken their entire pensions and thought, well, here's this thing that keeps going up in price, let me invest. Wall Street pumps, then dumps, and at that point, someone's lost their entire pension fund. And it's a problem. So from that perspective, I definitely think there needs to be regulation. Whether the regulation needs to be done specifically by the government is less clear. Fortunately, blockchain technology can be applied to these kinds of problems. So while blockchain technology is partially responsible for the problem existing in the first place, it also provides the potential for a solution.
One thing I should note real quick is that partial hash inversion thing that I talked about, that's called the proof of work algorithm. That is not integral to blockchain itself. That is just for certain implementations like Bitcoin and Ethereum.
Okay.
Yeah. So other functions can be used as ways to verify the blocks. So go on though.
Okay. Fair enough. I have included Ryan will pop it up into the show description, where we talk about the various other uses for blockchain tech. And I mean, don't get me wrong, this might be a very big game-changing technology for human society. The potential applications, from being able to vote using blockchain, where it provides mathematically rigorous counting. There's no way to defraud. Well, there are ways, but it becomes exceedingly difficult to defraud the voting system. That beautiful application. There are so many different kinds of applications, from energy tracking to voting to
triple entry bookkeeping for accounting.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of applications for blockchain tech. So while it is part of the problem, it can also form part of the solution. Moving on quickly. Some of the scams that have already been identified so far include a cryptocurrency startup, which was accused of fraudulently selling up to $15 million in tokens while advertising huge returns that it couldn't possibly deliver. They made up a company profile out of thin air, including a team of people that do not exist, and then hiding the shady past of the fraudster who was the head of the company. And this company Plex Corp, who...
That even sounds like a scam.
Yeah, Plex Corp, who created Plex Coin, are now being heavily investigated by the SEC, and hopefully something will come of that. Meanwhile, in India, you won't, like, if you go look up India Bitcoin scam, oh my God, there are so many scams. To list them all.
What was that stat? It was like 75% or some shit of like new cryptocurrencies are a scam.
Yeah. Yeah. And basically this relies on that 30% of the Bitcoin community not understanding what it is that they're getting into. They don't understand the tech. They don't understand how it all works. They just think to themselves, man, profit.
Money.
Money.
Get I'm money. Gonna get me, spend
I'm gonna
money.
Get some money. So instead of trying to list everything, because it'll take the rest of the episode, again, I'm just going to put up a link with a short summary that Ryan will pop up in the description. And it briefly covers a series of Ponzi schemes and fake cryptocurrencies, which are being used to defraud thousands of people of millions of dollars. I don't know if the Indians are using these to purchase Bobson, but Gene, I don't know. I don't know what it is that all of this money is being invested in. Now, I'm not an investor in much of anything. I don't like the idea of earning rents for doing nothing. But even as an uneducated investor, I would be very wary of any kind of market where the platforms on which I'm required to trade are completely unregulated. Now, with Bitcoin, the largest trading platform at the moment is Bitfinex, which one would assume is then the most reliable and secure. But this website doesn't even tell you who owns the platform or where it's operated from. I had to do quite a bit of digging before I found out that it is operated out of the British Virgin Islands. But nothing has drawn more criticism than the operation of Tether, which is a virtual currency that is supposed to be tied or tethered to the value of a dollar.
Oh, I get it. Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Damn. Man.
Now, customers can buy Tether coins on Bitfinex. What people don't seem to realize is Bitfinex and Tether are very closely tied together. So what they do is they buy Tether coins on Bitfinex and then transfer them to other virtual currency exchanges, providing a way to move dollars between countries without going through banks. Tether has also become a very popular way to buy Bitcoin. In recent weeks, a few hundred million dollars worth of Tether has changed hands on a daily basis across several exchanges, according to data that I found on coinmarketcap.com. Now, Tether and Bitfinex have insisted that the two operations are separate. But, I don't know if you remember, last November, the Paradise Papers came out. And in those leaked Paradise Papers, it shows that Appleby, which is an offshore law firm, they helped Mr. Potter and Mr. Devasini, who are the Bitfinex operators, to set up Tether in the British Virgin Islands. This was set up in 2014. So here you've got a platform that creates these tokens that are pegged to the dollar that you can then go and exchange across borders, across forms on various exchanges. Basically, it's the ultimate form of tax evasion, which obviously in the US, that's going to get you into some trouble if they ever manage to track you down.
Yeah, okay. They'll really fuck you for that.
Now, one... guy that I've been looking into quite a bit, a big critic of Bitfinex. He goes by the screen name Bitfinext. He's written several very detailed essays on Medium that argue that Bitfinex appears to be creating Tether coins out of thin air and then using them to buy Bitcoin and push the price up. So here you've got the largest Bitcoin exchange on the planet that is literally pumping the Bitcoin price.
Man, I've never heard of this before.
Yeah.
I wonder where they got this idea.
Gee, I wonder. At least they're learning from experience, people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, another big thing that's been happening is exit scams. Do people know what an exit scam is, do you think?
I think it's when you get someone to chase you, and then you run towards a mountain, and then you paint a tunnel on it, and then you run through the tunnel, but then they smash into it because it's actually just paint, right?
You're so, so very close.
Okay,
oh,
cool.
Man, and it's almost the perfect analogy. Okay, so an exit scam actually is when you do regular trading and you do regular trading and then you keep taking money in, but you stop deliveries. And because you've been a reliable trader for a while, people trust that there's just some sort of hiccup in and that there's a small delay or whatever. But then when they go to check up on, it's been 3 weeks since the last delivery, where's the new delivery? You're gone completely. And they've just invested a lot of money with you and you're gone. So, yeah. Basically, the idea is you have exited before you have given them what they have paid for. So you've basically stolen a bunch of money. You've robbed the bank on the Friday, and they don't find out about it until the Monday morning.
So what happens to the money, though?
Oh, you've got it.
Oh.
You as thief.
Oh, okay.
You've taken it, and you've transferred it into other accounts, and you've laundered it. Yeah, it's a fun way to run business. Now, some of you may remember back in 2016 when Evolution, which was a shadowy online drug market that customers could access only with an anonymous encryption software, when they shut down their market and took off with $12 million in customers' bitcoins. Anyone remember that? No?
I don't. Actually,
it was big on my radar, being, you know, the drug-addled reprobate that I am. Okay, so that was back in 2016. Apparently, the Bitcoin community didn't learn a single thing from this experience, as there have been multiple exit scams pulled since then. And the latest and possibly funniest to non-Bitcoin users.
I'm so glad I found this.
Yeah, so am I. It saw startup company Protium pull a fast one on its investors, leaving nothing but the word penis on their website, where investors were supposed to be able to check where their fruits and vegetables were coming from.
Okay, so that sentence may be a little confusing. So just to give a little background on Protium, many of you probably know what a PLU number is. If you don't, you should stop forcing your wife to do all the shopping for you, because that is the little number on a piece of fruit or a vegetable that you punch in at the register so that it can tell what you're buying, and then you weigh it on the scale and pay for it based on that. By the way, if you're going to one of those self-checkout things, just put in 4011 for whatever it is you grabbed. That's the PLU for bananas. Which are like 39 cents a pound or whatever. And then you can just get whatever you want for the price of bananas, which is a pretty great scam. So Protium was intended to replace the PLU number with a cryptocurrency that would tell you where the fruit came from, how it was grown, basically everything that rich health nuts love to talk about, all that kind of stuff.
Only use local produce.
Yeah, how many units of bicycle power was required to grow it? What sort of phytonutrients it has? What juicer to use for it? You know, whether to use the Ninja or the Vitamix to juice it. So yeah, Protium was supposed to replace the PLU number. I actually took a little gander at their white paper. It's actually pretty clear that it was a scam. They name dropped a couple of organizations that relate to produce, like some international produce growers thing, whatever. And then they had, you know, they had a timeline saying like, we're gonna create the Protium coin, and then we're gonna test it in Lithuania, normal place to test a highly advanced technology for tracking produce. All in all, it was about 8 or 10 pages long, and had very little information about anything. Pretty funny to look at.
And what's hilarious is that the people who would have invested in Protium are basically saying, we want to know more about the products we invest in. And then basically they're showing that the reason they need this product is because they suck at checking out things that they are going to invest in.
I never thought about that angle, but that's good.
God, the irony. Yeah, so they left. Instead of finding out where your banana came from, they just told you penis. We'll
best
put
possible
up
exit, by the way.
So we'll put up a link to that article as well. And there's a screenshot that you can check out of the webpage if you go to it now. I think it's been taken down since.
I think it now redirects to a raw water store.
Where they sell Tide Pods.
All right.
Okay, so all in all, Bitcoin has resulted in the loss of millions of dollars that has gone to fraudsters all over the world in the last 6 years. And look, big up to them for learning how to game a technology that is completely unregulated. It doesn't look like this is going to be able to go on for much longer, with countries from around the world looking to regulate Bitcoin exchanges and get involved in regulating Bitcoin as much as possible. I have got an entire list of the history of Bitcoin hacks and frauds. But it's an extensive list that goes all the way back to 2011 when the first hacks really started happening. The last thing I want to mention is that now we're starting to see things happen. Not all criminals are tech savvy for some reason. I don't know why. But more recently, and when I say more recently, I mean last week, we had the first ever official Bitcoin heist. And just to explain what happened here, a spokesperson for the Thames Valley police told the article's up on Mashable, told police that the police told Mashable that they're investigating an aggravated burglary which took place in a residential property in Molesford, Oxfordshire, on the 22nd of May. Now, just for references, Molesford is rich man country.
I don't feel bad for this bitch.
Yeah, don't feel too bad for this. But basically, the officers were called out at 9:40 a.m. To a report that offenders had entered a residential property off Reading Road and threatened the occupants. No one was seriously injured during the incident. The article doesn't tell us how much they took, but what they did basically was say, here's a Bitcoin wallet, transfer it all or we'll kill you. And I do think it's going to become more and more prevalent, especially as Bitcoin markets get regulated. People are the criminal elements that are intent on getting Bitcoin are going to turn to physical means to get the Bitcoin rather than trying to hack stuff and possibly get caught with a digital trail. So, yeah, Bitcoin, it is just, it's a big load of crap that is making lots of money for rich people, and is it's geared towards the harsher elements of society that are capable of figuring out ways to really screw things up.
Yeah. So we have a couple of other, you know, we've been talking about Bitcoin this whole time, and Protium too, which is a really great idea. There's actually a ton of other types of nerd money. Just to list
Wikipedia.
Off a couple.
Wikipedia lists 46 active cryptocurrencies at the moment.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
I mean, obviously it's not a comprehensive list, but it's the bigger names in the crypto community.
Yeah, so I thought it would be fun to just go through a couple of these. We don't have to go through even all the ones on this list. Some of them are just too funny not to mention. So one is Titcoin.
Which is awesome!
Yeah, that's real. Made specifically for use in adult entertainment. Yeah. I wonder what they mean by that. Is that like so unrated video games or?
No, if you want to buy porn, man.
Like Call of Duty?
Porn.
Call of Duty or Grand Theft Auto?
Yeah, that's definitely adult entertainment.
I don't know. What do you mean by porn? What is that? Can you explain it to me?
Pornography is when the boy person puts his wee inside the girl person. The other boy person.
God. No, don't. Don't do that. That sounds horrible.
Another interesting one, just following on Titcoin, is Banana Coin.
So, is that where you put bananas inside something else? I don't like where this is going.
Banana Coin was specifically developed to trade, you guessed it, penises. No, I mean bananas.
Oranges. Oh. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Bananas.
Yeah. Then you get different ones like the first smart contract to use blockchain tech was Burstcoin. And now more recently, Ether or Ethereum,
which also had a huge heist of almost $40 million last year, because the whole thing is there are contracts that are written in code, and the code is supposed to be the ultimate source of truth for the contract. So the intent doesn't matter. What actually matters is the code that's written out. And some fucking dumbass wrote one of the core contracts of the Ethereum system. And the way they wrote it is it takes a user-defined function to calculate how much to pay a user. And so, of course, someone wrote a user-defined function that just said, well, give me all your money then. Needless to say, the creators didn't like that. So they actually forked Ethereum completely to reverse the theft of the $40 million pot that they had there. So it didn't work out very well for them, I guess.
No, it didn't. Okay, another interesting one is, and I'm only mentioning this because I love memes. There is an internet meme of a dog.
It's actually a dog.
Yeah. It's a dog. And so based on this dog, someone went and created Dogecoin.
Yeah. It's a cute coin.
It's cute. That's about it.
I think I know a guy who actually had a bunch of Dogecoin.
Then you also get Potcoin.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Sorry, I forgot what I was talking about. Potcoin.
Wow, would you have a bong hit transplant there, buddy?
I wish.
Were you going to go to the hospital and get a bong hit transplant?
I wish. I miss marijuana. Potcoin is specifically for use in the cannabis industry. So cannabis growers in Colorado are using it to purchase seeds from guys up in Oregon or California or wherever, and you know, they're basically saying, here, have some imaginary money, which is just the same as all other kinds of imaginary money, and give me some of your weed.
That sounds dangerous. I had a friend who died from marijuana, and I've never been the same since. So,
marijuana injections are the worst.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway.
The last really interesting one is a digital currency in Venezuela that is backed by Venezuelan oil reserves called Petro.
So it's the socialist cryptocurrency, huh?
If the right wingers in the U.S. are to be believed, yes, that's exactly what it is.
Wow, what's the currency based on? The length of line to get food and toilet paper? How little toilet paper there is in the country? Is that what it's based on?
It's based on the scarcity of food in the country.
Did you know they don't have toilet paper there? Did you know that?
Man.
If you like socialism so much, hope you don't like wiping your ass, buddy. Because in socialism, they don't have toilet paper.
But I prefer leaves.
No, you gotta squat like a monkey, and you gotta shit in a little hole, and then you don't get any toilet paper because socialists can't make it because there's no motivation to have toilet paper. So,
okay.
Guess you didn't think about that, did you, bud?
No, I didn't. I didn't, because I'm a selfish socialist.
Uh-oh, someone's calling me again. I don't know who this is, so bye. All right, I'm going to meet my damn phone next time.
Yeah, I think that might be a good idea, so you don't keep interrupting our dedicated listeners, okay? I think you're being even more selfish than I am, Ryan.
Apparently
right
I'm
now.
As fast of a learner as these Bitcoin folks.
Okay. So that was our episode on Bitcoin.
Summarize, invest in Bitcoin. Invest all the money that you have.
Yeah, because the
then
price
you'll
is
going to
go up forever, and you'll make everything will cost nothing. And
yeah, if I remember what
money.
You said earlier, you said the price was at 20,000 right now, and then jumped to 22,000 while we were recording, right?
Yeah. It's something like that.
So things are looking good for
now.
Bitcoin.
I'm looking it up now. It was on 3,000, and now it's on 999. No, sorry, 11,000. Sorry, it's moving too fast. 14,000. No, 2,000.
Well, that's supply and demand, folks.
Okay. If you guys want to follow us on Twitter, you can find the podcast at Neighbor SciPod.
Twitter didn't give us 280 for the handle there, so we had to shorten it a little bit. That's okay. Neighbor SciPod, I think, is fairly easy to remember.
You can find us on Facebook at the easier Neighbor Science page.
Yeah, just Neighbor Science. You can go to our website, postscarcitymagazine.com. The podcast is on there. I didn't really think through like saying the links to things on the site, so I didn't really make a very good URL scheme. I'll probably fix that sometime in the future, but it's kind of a huge pain in the ass. So,
For now,
definitely not doing
it
anytime soon.
Yeah, for now, just suffer. All of you.
Just go to postscarcitymagazine.com, click podcast, and it'll be there. We also have our zine up there. I haven't done an issue in a while. Might do one soon. Don't know. You can also follow Peter on Twitter at bookcheekite, BookCheekite. And then me, you can find at Handle of Rye. That's like, a handle of rye, but without the E, because my name's Rye. And, we have a Patreon, patreon.com/neighborscience. Where you can support us. We're trying to get Peter some better sound equipment, better mic there.
I don't sound.
Sounds like one of those adult entertainment videos you were talking about.
Yeah,
you can get some land holdings if you go to a high enough tier. You get some feudal land holdings. We're working on getting a manor. I think we established that it's going to be on the moon because, as I said before, I found out that I am a descendant of the moon race. Very important family among the moon race. But, you know, so my land holdings are not going to be on Earth, unfortunately. But we will have Gundams, so that'd be cool. Yeah, maybe we'll add a reward tier if you give us $100 a month, you get your own Gundam. How do you think? What do you think about that?
I think it's perfect.
Okay,
it's
cool.
Okay, everyone, thank you very much for tuning in, and we will hear from you next week.
Well, no, they'll hear from us, but yeah, they get it. They get it. They're smart.
It's not a two-way thing?
No.
Yeah.
Maybe we can make it that way. We'll set a goal and get walkie-talkies for everyone, and then they can walkie-talkie us while we're recording. That'll be good.
Yeah, that won't be a shit show at all. Okay, everyone.
All right, bye.
Good chat. Later.